most people, either from youth, childhood, other times, we are in some way acquainted with Sefer Yehoshua, with Sefer Shmuel. By the time we make it to Malachim, we're not terribly acquainted with Sefer Malachim. The only time one can become a bit acquainted with it is, of course, if one will attend a year's shiurim on the Haftarot. There are about, I think, 17 or 18 Haftarot that come from Sefer Malachim. And by the way, when I speak of Shmuel and Malachim, I didn't speak about Shmuel Aleph or Shmuel Bet or Malachim Aleph or Malachim Bet. We've pointed out a long time ago that the division of Shmuel and Malachim into two separate books does not come from Jewish sources, according to the Gemara, and according to our counting of the 24 Kitvei HaKodesh, the 24 holy books. If you're going to have Shmuel Aleph and Bet, and Malachim Aleph and Bet, and Divrei Hayamim Aleph and Bet, you're going to end up with 27 books, not 24. It was the Christian world that divided it into two to make it more manageable in the course of their debates, the forced debates with Jews, so that you should be able to cite chapter and verse. Malachim is big, Shmuel is big. But the fact is, I don't usually like to begin a year with all sorts of introductions. I like to get directly into the text, because that's really what we're here to study, and the introductions are going to come as they are necessary. Of course, it's referred to, it's called Sefer Malachim, because the story of 20 kings from the house of David are going to be described, and the story of 20 kings who served over the secessionist 10 tribes of Israel that are going to break away and create their own kingdom. So here it's fascinating. Over a period of 400 years, there are 20 kings, all from one family, Ben Achar Ben, one coming after the other. And in a period of 150 to 200 years, there are 20 kings from 9 different families who are the kings of Israel. There wasn't much continuity in the kingdom or the royal houses of Israel. In the house of David, there is going to be continuity throughout. Though, of course, there are going to be moments of crisis. And the first moment of crisis is that which opens up the Sefer. So we're just going to start learning. Some of you may even be slightly familiar with the first chapter of Malachim. That may be one of those that you are familiar with. It's a long chapter, 53 psukim, but the first 32 psukim are the Haftorah for Parashat Chaye Sarah. And as we go through the first half of the chapter, I think what we have to keep in mind is that Parashat Chaye Sarah, and I'm going to attempt to explain the relationship between the two. But meanwhile, let's just begin. And you know, of course, at the beginning of every year I have grandiose plans. I don't even know whether I should mention them. Like, to really finish Malachim in one year, that would be an accomplishment. It's the biggest of the Nevi'im Rishonim, bigger than Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel. And there's a great deal here that is important, both from the point of view of Jewish philosophy, Jewish history. There's a great deal that we can learn from here. For events that are taking place before our very eyes today, things change and yet they remain the same. Genug v'hamelech David zaken bo bayamim. Sefer Malachim begins with Hamelech David zaken bo bayamim. He was old, he had come in days. Vayechasuhu ha'begadim below yichamlo. They covered him with garments, but it did not warm him. The Mefarshim say that some say simply it was a matter, it was a function of age. The Gemara, of course, says that it was a punishment because he had torn the garment of Shaul. In one of the incidents in the book of Shmuel, it says that David came upon Shaul when he was sleeping and he tore his garment. And because he tore his garment, so at the end of his life, when he needed the warmth of garments no longer afforded him that warmth. Of course, the idea that is being expressed by our rabbis is that one has to respect even the inanimate object. Rashi brings it from the Gemara that when Moshe Rabbeinu is told to turn the waters of the Nile into blood, he's not the one who strikes the Nile, it's his brother Aaron. Why doesn't Moshe strike the Nile? Because the Nile concealed him. The Nile protected him when he was a little baby in the basket. And therefore he is not the one that's going to turn the waters of the Nile into blood. And the same thing is true for Tzardeya, where the scourge of Tzardim are supposed to come out of the Nile. The third of the plagues that were brought against the Egyptians was where he threw the earth of Egypt heavenward and it turned into kinim, lice throughout the land. He owed a debt of gratitude even to the earth of Egypt, because when he killed the Egyptian, he buried him and covered him in the sands of Mitzrayim. Rav Dessler, in one of his essays, says that there's a great deal that we learn here. The question, of course, is, does an inanimate object know the difference? Was Saul's garment really so profoundly hurt by the fact that David cut it? I mean, if you cut it, it bleedeth not. Was the Nile, I should have used the blood with regard to the Nile. If you hit it, it will indeed bleedeth. Does an inanimate object feel? Does it have feelings? So what's the difference? God commands him to turn the Nile into blood. Let the Nile turn into blood. Let him do it. So the point that's made by Rav Dessler is gratitude is rooted in the recipient and not in the recipient and not the one who gives the good. In other words, if gratitude is, I have to express my gratitude to you. You were good to me. And the essence of the gratitude is rooted in the one who did me the favor. And I'm now repaying the favor. So therefore, if you're aware of the fact that I'm expressing gratitude, then you express gratitude. But if you're unaware, you're an inanimate object, so why express gratitude? Says Rav Dessler, gratitude is something that must come from the recipient and the beneficiary. How I feel. It's not how you're going to feel. It's how I feel. And you did something for me, then I have to feel the gratitude. And if it is rooted in the recipient and the beneficiary, then it makes no difference where the good came from. It can be an inanimate object. It's the me, I, who received the benefit. I am the one who's supposed to feel and sense the gratitude. Therefore, it makes no difference. It makes no difference where it comes from. The Gemara says, because he had shown disrespect for a garment, therefore, when he needed it, vayechasuhu babigadim, they covered him with garments below yichamlo. Where does it say zakein ba bayamin? The term zakein, an elder, bought Baba Yamin, says by Avram, and it says it by Sarah, and it says it by Yehoshua bin Nun. Those are the three other places where it says Zakein Baba Yamin, which of course we already immediately have a relationship between Parashat Chaye Sarah and this Haftarah, because there it says Avraham Zakein Baba Yamin. What's the meaning of Zakein? One who's old, who has come in days. What does it mean to come in days? Saisor Rav Zevin once wrote very beautifully, many people come to the end of life and then they turn around and they think to themselves, where did the time go? Where did the years go? What happened to it all? Was anything done? Was anything accomplished? There are unique people who can come to the end of their days and they come with all of their days in hand. They can account for all of their days. It was a life full of accomplishment. There are ways and means of freezing moments in time. I know Kodak always says, you know, you take a picture, so you've frozen a moment in time. Torah says, do a mitzvah, and therefore that moment takes on the cloak of eternity. So that when one comes toward the end of life, one comes with all of one's days in one's hands. Avram and Sarah and Yehoshua and David, about them, because each one represented a milestone in Jewish history. Avram and Sarah are, of course, the parents of the Jewish people. Yehoshua is the one who brings them into Eretz Yisrael, the second great step. And David, of course, is the one who establishes, or through whom is established, the royal house that is going to be the eternity, not only of the Jewish people, but of history itself, from David through Mashiach. These people, their lives were lives of accomplishment. Zaken, everybody. We pray that everybody should grow old, but not everybody is bar bayamim, comes with all of the days in hand. Alright, further. Vayom lo avodav, his servant said to him, Yevachul Adoni HaMelech Na'ara Betula, let them seek for my master, the king, Na'ara Betula, a virgin girl, Va'amdol Lefnei HaMelech, who will stand before the king. Now the term Va'amda doesn't mean stand physically. Va'amda means one who stands ready to serve, one who is ready and available. Va'amdol Lefnei HaMelech, and she will stand before the king, U'tehilo Sochenet, and she will be one who will serve him. Or Sochenet can also mean one to warm him. V'shachva b'chekecha, and she will lie in your chek, lap. V'cham la'adoni HaMelech, and it will be warm for my master the king. The human body gives off a great deal of warmth. There is something that's very fascinating here. Those of you who recall, in Sefer Shmuel, after the David's great error with Bathsheba, Natan Hanavi comes to him, and he tells him a story of two people that lived in a city. A rich man who had a lot of sheep and cattle, and a poor man who had only one shevselah. And he was very close with this shevselah. And you know what it says? You know what Natan told him there? This shevselah was so beloved by the poor man, the owner, that she would lie in his lap, and she provided warmth for him. There was a certain relationship between the two. I have this feeling as though the Pasuk here is using metaphors that were used there in order to let us know that here is another and a final test for David. David's life has changed dramatically from the story of Bathsheba on and further. His home is one that has become a place of infighting, machloket. We have his eldest son Amnon is killed by Avshalom. Avshalom then rebels against his father until he is put to death and the rebellion is crushed. So there was Amnon and Tamar, Amnon and Avshalom. There was a third son over there in the middle, really son number two. There were four amongst the children that were born to David in Hebron at the beginning of his kingdom. There was Amnon, Kilav, who in Divrei Hayomim is referred to as Daniel, about whom we never hear. And the Mepharshim say, huh? They say he died, yes. But we don't hear anything about Kilav. Avshalom, unfortunately, we heard a great deal about. And the fourth son is the one about whom this story is going to be. So that in a sense, it seems that everything all started back there with the chet of Bathsheba, And therefore similar terms are used here in order to create that memory association. The shachva there, Natan said, the shachva b'cheiko, she would lie in his lap. So it says, v'yivakshu na'ara yafa, they looked for a beautiful girl. By the way, in the prescription of his doctors or his servants, it didn't say she had to be beautiful. Yivakshu ladoni amelech, na'ara b'sula, virgin girl. But it seems that they extend this to mean also a beautiful girl. B'chol kvul yisrael, within the entire boundaries of Israel. V'yimtzu, and they found it, avishak ha-shunamit. V'yaviu atal ha-melech, they found a girl by the name of avishak ha-shunamit, who came from a city called Shunem. Shunem is going to be important later on in Sefer Melachim as well. Shunem, and this is one of the great things about, well, living here and having a parish that tells you exactly where Shunem is, it's 4 kilometers east of Afula. And for those of you who may not have known up until now where Afula is, I think now you're beginning to know where Afula is, because it's 10 or 12 kilometers from Jenin, which unfortunately is being evacuated today. So Shunem is 4 kilometers east of Afula. It's sort of toward the eastern end of Emek Israel, the Jezreel Valley. And they brought her to the king. Not simply beautiful, but she is very beautiful. She was for the king, one who stood before him and served him. But the king did not know her sexually. In a sense, it's more than a sense, David is not going to heir again, though she could have been permitted to him. This was all permissible. In a sense, I think it's Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz who writes in the Sefer Ahavat Yonatan, in keeping with the words of the Rambam, where the Rambam says that real tshuva is when a person is faced with precisely the same situation and he does not do what he did because of tshuva. In a sense, a similar situation is being reenacted here, according to the Gemara, because David HaMelech has 18 wives, which is the limit that a king is permitted. So therefore, she is not permitted to him. The HaMelech lo yidah. Huh? Obviously, it would seem that no, it had to be Na'ara b'sula. In the parish of Dat Mikra, that's written by Yehuda Kiel, so he writes that he has a son-in-law who's a doctor, and the son-in-law, the doctor told him, yes, that it's absolutely true, and that there are places in the world where there's something called a therapy called shunamism, from Avishag HaShunamit. There's a certain kind of warmth that for a particular kind of illness can only be provided. Yep, I mean, I'm ready to accept that. If we are now to describe the palace of David, David is reaching the end of his life. He's Zakein, and he's not only Zakein, he's Zakein Baba Yamin. He's ill. He is ill. It does not seem that he is functioning as king anymore. We will even see in another few psukim that for all intents and purposes, David HaMelech is isolated not only from the country, not only from Yerushalayim, he is isolated from everything taking place even within the palace. He is there in his room, he is weak, he is growing older and weaker, and we're going to see how the Pasuk is going to describe it. It means that what's happened now is there is a vacuum that has created. The king is not yet dead, but it doesn't seem that he certainly is not alive and functioning. And it is into this vacuum that son number four, it steps. If David HaMelech didn't suffer for so many years, this is the suffering that he's going to have on what is nearly his, well, what is going to be his deathbed. V'Adoniyahu ben Chagit mitnasei. Adoniyahu ben Chagit, son number four. Chagit, remember, is the name of his of his mother. His mother's name was Chagid. So if you thought that these kind of names are the creation of modern Israel, you know, Sarid, Shmarid, everything with an it at the end, there was a Chagid. And according to some of the Mefarshim, either she was born on a Yontif and she was called Chagid, or it was a Yontif for her parents when she was born, so they called her Chagid. Adoniyahu ben Chagid mitnasei, he is the one who begins to raise and elevate himself, lema saying, Ani emloch, I will rule. He has the right to assume that he's going to be king, because he is the eldest surviving son. He should be the heir to the throne. And because he feels ani emloch, that I am going to rule, what he begins to do, therefore, is act like one who is going to rule. And here we have psukim that are merely repeats of the psukim that was said with regard to Avshalom. Avshalom began to act regally in the streets of Yerushalayim. He began to act like the one who is going to assume the throne. Vayas lo rechev uparashim, he made for himself a chariot with horses, v'chamishim ish rotzim lefanav, and 50 people running before him. This was the indication of Malchus. We, during the course of a year, we suffer from this very often. Every visiting dignitary who's at the King David and wants to go from the King David to the President's house, so you understand, so he has to come along Jabotinsky, and it's usually in the middle of our learning, you hear all of the motorcycles that are going before, and then you know that some two-bit ruler who's most probably being unseated back in his African country is on his way to the Bet Hanasi up the block. But that's Malchus. To act royally and regally, and he has 50 people who are running before him, precisely the same things that Avshalom did. And here comes a pasuk that at the same time that it is so painful, it is also so beautiful. It's painful, yet profound. V'lo'atzovo aviv miyav miyav lemor. His father had never, atzovo can mean either pained him, or upset him, or depressed him. Father never said to him, Madua kacha asita, why did you do such and such? Father never dressed him down. Father never disciplined him. V'gam utov tarm yod. He's also very good looking. And v'oto yolda acharei Avshalom. Chagid gave birth to him after Avshalom was born to Macha. The mother of Avshalom is Macha. So that means in this pasuk, we have all of the reasons why he has the right to assume that he's going to be the next king. But I think the order is the order is fascinating. Number one, the pasuk says his father never disciplined him. Second thing, the pasuk says he's very good looking. And there is something about a person who's good looking that is charismatic. It works two ways. He thinks he's special, and he thinks he's unique and different, and he's made to rule, and people around him are drawn to him because of his good looks. And his mother gave birth to him after Avshalom. If we would be writing the pasuk, what order would we put the... We would put the last one first, right? In other words, what gives him the right, so to speak, the right? What legally would establish him as the pretender to the throne? The fact that he's born next. He's now the oldest son. But the pasuk leaves that last. The pasuk writes first the fact that his father never disciplined him. And then second, the pasuk writes his own feelings. And I believe, number one, but let's say the main question over here is the following. Whatever steps he is taking without consultation with his father. And that's the big problem. How does he do that? So if the only reason why he would be in line for the throne is by right of birth, then he would have spoken to his father. But he has two other problems. He doesn't feel that, I'm going to say something, I don't know, I'll throw it out. A father who disciplines children develops a relationship with them. Because his father never disciplined him, there was no relationship. Sometimes we think, you know, parents are afraid or reluctant or hesitant to discipline children because, oh, he's not going to like me. And what the Pasuk is saying is precisely the opposite. If he would have disciplined them, there would have been a relationship. If there would have been a relationship, it would never have occurred to him to go and begin to assume the reins of kingdom without talking to the king.
There's something else. That a child who is never disciplined, I don't know from which side, but it seems to me that it's a lack of love.
All right, so that, of course, is, I have to explain why did I say that it's a painful pasuk, that's for sure. But why did I say that it's a profound pasuk, or what did I say the beauty of the pasuk? The beauty of the pasuk is the fact that the Navi spares no words and says what has to be said about David. In most other literature, you will not find great heroes, the characters who are so important, being so roundly and summarily criticized. I mean, the criticism of David is beautiful. Yes.
Doesn't show love.
Toby, it doesn't say any place that Avraham loved Yitzchak. The only one who says Avraham loved Yitzchak is when God, by the Akeda, says, Kachno es bincha es yichidcha, asher ahavta es Yitzchak. If you're going to go through Tanakh, you're not going to find very many expressions of love. Those of you who were here last year when we learned Shmuel, the one place where the term love is used 3, 4, 5 times in one chapter, if I'm not mistaken, it's chapter 18 in Shmuel Bet, for lack of a better way to say it, chapter 18 of Shmuel Bet, where it says the people love David. They love David very much. And all the servants of the king love David. We have to assume that the relationship between parents and children is a good relationship. Unless we're told otherwise. By virtue of the... Yeah, all right. So, and there it was pointed out that does it mean he doesn't love his other children? There it was, because the love became problematic.
But you know the others love their wives.
It does say that Yitzchak loved Rivka, that's true. But the point that I want to make is to make a broad statement saying that David has no relationship with his children is something that this pasuk is telling us is simply not so. David had a relationship with all of his children. He had a relationship with Adoniyahu ben Chagit, but that was not a meaningful relationship by virtue of the fact that he did not discipline him. So I'm saying we're afraid to discipline because we think we're going to lose the love of children. What we don't realize is it is precisely through the criticism or the musar, and you know, then of course all sorts of things will happen. A child may bring to my attention that I'm criticizing them unjustly. And then if I'm big enough, I may even turn around and say I'm sorry. You know, that creates a relationship. So I say what's beautiful about this painful pasuk is that the pasuk can say about David HaMelech, yes, he failed over here, and he's going to pay the price. Melachim was written by the by Yirmiyahu and Anshei Knesset HaGdolah.
There's also an idea of problematic relationship he had with his father. But he was sort of the odd man out.
Yeah, you know, I understand. You see, I'm always frightened of getting into these things when we become amateur psychologists and we put the Gedolei HaTanakh out on our imaginary couches. I always feel that we're treading on extremely dangerous ground. I try to stay away from it. As I mentioned this week, you know, the, you know, we're talking about Chum. By the way, I owe you an answer yet. There's a Rashi and a Sisich Chum I have to show you about the order of their ages. It seems Chum was the middle. But all right, we'll talk about that later. So I remember I pointed out that, you know, if Chum is the middle child, so then one can already begin to say, well, now we know what went wrong with Chum. Yefet is the oldest, so he's the Chachkala. Shem is the youngest, so he's the Mezinical, you understand. And therefore, we already decide exactly why everything that goes wrong with Chum is because he's a middle child, and middle children are just they're the ones that suffer. It's very dangerous. You can't do that with Tanakh. All right, yes. No, it's not that he didn't discipline Amnon, and he said nothing to Avshalom. However, the not saying to Avshalom, that was also a form of discipline, because there was no question about it that he's angry. The anger can be expressed by breaking off a relationship. Later, even when Yoav ben Tzruya is able to convince David to bring Avshalom back to Yerushalayim from exile, for 2 years, he will not see Avshalom. He will not see Avshalom for 2 years. So there is also in the lack of relating, there is also a mussar in that. Therefore, the only way that I can know that he acted improperly in his relationship to a child is where the pasuk says it. If the pasuk doesn't say it, then I'm on very shaky ground. Unless I'll find one of the mefarshim, unless I will find a maimer chazal, otherwise I say it's a scary thing to begin to psychoanalyze the Gedaliah Tanna. Right, weiter. The story. So, right, so the pasuk has told us three reasons. Three reasons why Adoniyahu ben Chagit is beginning to take the reins of the kingdom. He's never been disciplined by his father, and therefore he doesn't feel the need to discuss it with his father because he doesn't have a relationship with him. He personally feels that he is the one who is worthy of being king because of his good looks. And Ba'oto Yodach Re'ev Shalom, I even have a feeling that this is sort of a like an afterthought there. And by the way, he legally also has a claim to be the next one along. Vayiyu Devarav, and he spoke, or he acted, together with Yoav ben Tzeruya, V'in Evyatar HaKohen, Vayazru Acharei Adoniyo. What happens over here is a conspiracy of people who are concerned that they have lost favor in the eyes of David, and they want a king who is going to be beholden to them. Yoav ben Tzruya has been the commander-in-chief of the forces of David for 40 years. He's most probably been the person closest to him, but he knows, Yoav ben Tzruya knows, that David dislikes him. I think dislike is most probably a very mild word to use. I think that one could say that David hates Yoav ben Tzruya. Yoav ben Tzruya is the one who has killed Avner ben Ner. Avner ben Ner. Where's Avner ben Ner buried? Yeah. She knows everything she knows. Because I'll tell you, Cholamayit, when I went to the Ma'ara, I was about the only one who decided just to walk off a little bit to the right as I came out, and I went to pray by the kever of Avner ben Ner. It's right there outside the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Okay. Just want you to know. Don't think it's only the Ma'arat HaMachpelah that we have and 450 heroes who live in Hebron. Avner ben Ner is buried in Hebron. He killed, Yoav killed Avner ben Ner, he killed Amasa ben Yeter, he was the one who put Avshalom to death. So that there's a long cheshbon here between David and Yoav. Why does David tolerate Yoav all of these years? So in one place it says that David says about himself that, what am I going to do with these sons of Tzeruya? They are stronger than me and I'm young and new now in the kingdom. It's also Mishpucha. Who's Tzeruya? Tzeruya is David's sister. Yoav is his nephew. But more than that, Yoav is an outstanding commander-in-chief. When the Mishnah in Masechta Makot, when the Mishnah says the following, the Mishnah says that a person who flees to a city of refuge because he has killed somebody unintentionally, Eino Yotzei Misham La'olam, never has the right to leave that city of refuge, afilu kol Yisrael tzrichim lo, even if all of Israel needs him. And the Mishnah wants to give an example of who is somebody that all of Israel needs. Ki Yoav ben Tzruya sar tzva Yisrael, like Yoav ben Tzruya is the commander-in-chief of the forces of Israel. What we set a series of shiurim last year in which we pointed out something else that's extremely important to know about Yoav ben Tzruya, and many of the psukim that the Gemara uses in order to describe the character and the personality of Yoav are going to come in these first two chapters of Malachim. Yoav ben Tzruya was a great Talmid Chacham. Yoav ben Tzruya was a great Baal Tzedakah. Yoav ben Tzruya had a home that was open to everybody. And more than anything else, Yoav ben Tzruya was dedicated and devoted to Malchut Beit David. As far as he was concerned, the most important thing is to establish firmly the house of David. That, to him, is his life's mission, to which he dedicates and he devotes himself completely. Therefore, as far as he is concerned, if Avner ben Ner, who is the commander-in-chief of the forces of Shaul, and then it's Ishbosheth afterwards, if he suspects that this man may very well be ready to undermine the house of David, he is going to make certain that no threat exists before the house of David. So too with Amasa ben Yeter, and so too with Avshalom. Avshalom is not merely a threat. Avshalom is the one who has in fact rebelled and was successful for a while in his rebellion against the house of David. This he will not tolerate. This is the personality, the raison d'etre of Yoav ben Tzruya's Malchus Beis David. But what's going to happen now is, as far as Yoav ben Tzruya is concerned, he doesn't care which one of the children of David is going to be the next king, as long as it is somebody from Malchut, from the house of David, so that Malchut Beit David continues. Of course, he has a personal interest, and the personal interest is the one that he wants to make certain that he's going to be protected, that he's going to maintain his job by being in on the ground floor together with Adon Yoav and Chagit, and he may very well have been captivated by the personality of Adon Yahu ben Chagit, his good looks and all of the trappings of Malchus. Eviatar HaKohen is the one who's been removed from the Kohuna Gedola, from being the high priest, by David. Something is happening over here that really takes us back to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Eviatar is from the house of Eli. And the house of Eli at the beginning of Shmuel, the house of Eli is coming to an end, and it's going to end with Eviatar. So here it is, Adon Yoav ben Chagit, as in all, you know, the second way, the third way, or, you know, the fifth way, they all get together, and everybody has their own interest. So Yoav ben Tzruya, Eviatar Kohen, Vayazru Acharei Adon Yoav, and they assisted Adon Yoav. Who's not invited? But Tzadok HaKohen, Tzadok, the one who has now been appointed Kohen by David, who Benoyahu ben Yehoyada. Benoyahu ben Yehoyada was the commander-in-chief of the elite forces, the Kreti Uplati. According to the Gemara, it means that he was the head of the Sanhedrin. There was just something that I noticed today, you know, the name Benoyahu ben Yehoyada, just as, you know, in passing. And all of these names, you'll see that many of the names have the name of God in it. Benoyahu means the one who understood or comprehended God. Bona, Bina, from Havanah, to understand God. He was the son of Yehoyada. Yehoyada means the one who knew God. I just had this fascinating feeling that if the father is one who knows God, the son deepens it by being the one who understands God. From Yada, from Yediya, you go to Bina. And maybe for that reason he is the head of the Sanhedrin. V'natan anavi, v'shim'i, v'rei'i, v'hakiborim, asher v'david, and the mighty ones who are with David, lo hoyu im Adon Yahu, they were not with Adon Yahu. Adon Yahu now, this day, Adon Yahu has now taken a much, much greater step. Vayizbach Adoniyo, son Ubakar Umedi, im Eben Hazochelet Asher, Eitzel Ein Rogel. Eitzel Ein Rogel, remember we talked about where Ein Rogel is? I asked where Ein Rogel is. He slaughters, Adoniyo slaughters, it means he commands. They're going to make, there's a big party. So sheep and cattle and fattened sheep in Evan Hazochelet, the stone, Evan Hazochelet, which is near Ein Rogel. Now, where is Ein Rogel, the place, not the street? Where is Ein Rogel? Yeah, I said, where is the place, not the street? The street is named after the place. Huh? But between Binyamin and Yehuda is very good. Yes, we're near there. So in other words, Iratika, okay, old city, wall around the city. You come out from the Kotel Shar HaAshba. You come out of Shar HaAshba and you turn left. You turn left. So the eastern section, the eastern part of the city, in other words, between the old city and Har HaZeitim, is Nachal Kidron. At the corner where Nachal Kidron meets with what's along the south side, what's the south side of the old city? Gay Ben Hinnom. Gay Ben Hinnom, and then that meets with, I think we have to take you out for a field trip. Oh, my wife likes, she always likes that idea. So we should learn. I'll tell you, the easiest thing, of course, is if you take out your Yerushalayim telephone book, in the middle, there are a few beautiful maps of the city. So you'll see the map of the old city, Ein Rogel is there, Nachal Kidron, and where Nachal Kidron meets Gay Ben Hinnom. It's not far from Silwan, because that was Ir David. So, and Eben HaZochelet, what was this Eben HaZochelet? According to some of the Mephoshim, Zochel means to flow or to drip. There was water that came through over there. The water ends up at the Nikvat HaShiloach, which is further down. Some of the Mephoshim say Eben HaZochelet was a sort of, I'm afraid to use the word, an itstadion. There were stones, big rocks there where young men used to test their strength. So that was one of the gathering places of the city, and there he goes. Vayikret kol echop bnei amelech, he called all of his brothers, the sons of the king, ulechol anshei Yehuda avdei amelech, and to all of the people of Yehuda, the servants of the king. Vet natan anavi ubenayahu vet hakibodim vet shlomo achiv lo kara. He did not call natan anavi nor benayahu, and here it says also his brother Shlomo, he did not call. Open to question, but you're running ahead of us. You're running. So that's certain. The fact that the pasuk points out that Shlomo Achiv Lo Kara, he called his brothers, but he didn't call his brother Shlomo. That means he sees Shlomo as being the threat. The question is, why does he see Shlomo as being the threat? Is it because the promise that was made by David to Bathsheba is known? I'm not so certain. Is it because Shlomo already has a reputation of tremendous wisdom, and therefore he sees him as the threat? I see that more as the reason. Because it seems not everybody is aware of the prophecy. Natan has prophesied that Shlomo is going to be king. David is the one who has sworn, we're going to see, and sworn to Bathsheba that her son is going to be king. It doesn't seem to be common knowledge out there. If it would be, so then why doesn't he invite Natan? Because he knows who are the people that are close to David. He knows that Natan Anavi and David and Benayahu and Shlomo, and it points out that his brother Shlomo, his Echov Bnei HaMelech, he did invite. His brothers, the other princes, he did invite. He does invite Shlomo. Shlomo, even without knowing what God's plans or what David's plans are, Shlomo's a threat. Though he's young, but he's a threat. They know that he's brilliant. I only listed the first four. I only listed the first four in order to let you know what happened to the first three, and that the remaining one, the oldest one, is Adonio, but there are many other children. Vayomer Natan al Betsheva. Natan said to Betsheva, Aim Shlomo, the mother of Shlomo, Lamer, so saying. Now, sometimes a whole story can be told not in a word, but in a word that doesn't appear. How do you like that? The omission of a word tells us a tremendous story. One of the things I always like to make people sensitive to is the, not merely beauty, but the profundity of the biblical narrative. This is not Stam writing. Everything here is weighed and measured. There's a word that's missing in this pasuk that is going to tell us a tremendous story. Okay, that's a Talmidah over there. Hanavi. Natan has been referred to up until now as the Navi. He's not referred to as the Navi now. Why is he not referred to as the Navi now? You know what's going to happen now? This Natan is now going to tell Bathsheba that if you're not, you should know that Adoniyahu ben Chagit is now in the process of making himself king. If you're not going to do something about it, then you should know that you and your son Shlomo are going to be in grave physical danger. And then he tells her what to do. He tells her that she should go to the king and tell him such and such. It's a plot. I mean, this is a conspiracy. And he says, while you're in the middle of speaking to David, I'm going to appear suddenly. And I am going to add and complete everything to what you said. He's plotting and planning every step of the way in order to get David to do something about the terrible situation. So I always ask, why doesn't Natan Hanavi simply sit back on that unusual day in the palace? If I would be him, I don't know, I'd take my shoes off, put on my slippers, sit back in and relax and watch these mere mortals running around trying to frustrate God's plan. Because he's a Navi, and he's not only the Navi, he is the one who has said that Shlomo is going to be the next king. Let Adonio ben Chagit make all the parties that he wants. Is that them gunished helfen? Why doesn't Natan simply sit back and say, listen, let all these people run around? In Yiddish, you would say, be pasamte mois. Like poisoned mice. They're running around. Can you imagine what it... Listen, we know already what it means to put together a tekes, to put together a ceremony establishing this as king. Can you imagine all of the plotting and all of the planning and all of the... just to get the caterer ready for an event of this sort. And there are rechev and there are parashim, there are people running back and forth and messages are being sent, one if by land, two if by sea. There's so many things that are happening all over, in the palace, outside of the palace, and Ein Rogel and Eben Azokhalet. But there's one man who knows that it's all for naught. There's one man who knows that the next king is going to be Shlomo, and that man is Natan HaNavi. Why does he get involved over here? Let him sit back. The message, obviously, is that man never has the right to sit back. It is the responsibility of man, when he sees something that's happening that's wrong, it is his responsibility to act.
Wait,
or better. That's right. Nashon, what's Nashon and Amen? What's he jumping for? God, you took us out of Mitzrayim. You promised you're bringing us to Eretz Yisrael. Show me what you can do. Sit back and show me what you can do. What does the Rebbe Yisrael say over there? Daber al Bnei Yisrael. Speak to the children of Israel, be so, and they shall journey. I say that's the relationship between this Haftorah and Parshat Chayisara. Didn't God make a promise, ki b'Yitzchak yikare l'chazara, that Yitzchak is going to be the father of a Jewish people? What's Avram getting so upset looking for a shidduch? Avram should sit back and shoot the Rebbeinu, we're going to send a marriage made in heaven. Rebbeinu, you promised that Yitzchak is going to be the father of a great people? So right, show me what you can do. Send some, you send three dusty Arabs along the road, you understand, and I brought them into my house. Okay, some damsel in distress is going to pass the house, and she's going to be the one whom you've chosen for Yitzchak. That's not what Avraham does. All of the planning, a whole sedra, sending Eliezer and what Eliezer does and when Eliezer comes to the well, everything, all of this is being done by Avraham because Avraham understands that man has to act, and it may very well be that's exactly how the Revelation wants it to happen. Yes, he wants Avram to send Eliezer, and Eliezer is going to go with his 10 camels, and he's going to find Rivka. And you know where God is going to act? They act as partners. He sends Rivka out to the well. You know, a lot of girls are coming out. Isn't it fascinating, the first girl that he talks to? This is Rivka from the house of Lavan. If man takes the great leap and the step, and the Revelation is going to respond. Natan Hanavi knows that he wears two hats, or for that matter, he wears one hat, and sometimes he doesn't wear his hat. No, he always wore a hat. Okay, he wore a hat as a Navi. But he's also Natan. And here, from here on, through the Perek, he's acting as the commoner, Natan, who has a responsibility, despite the fact that he knows what the end is going to be. He knows what the end is. But that man is never free from going ahead and doing whatever he has to do. Man has a responsibility to act. He can't simply sit back and let things happen. Yes?
Is there any reason why you would say has the past tense instead of present tense?
Which pasuk are you talking about?
Right here. He says, God has rained. Why doesn't he just say Hagat is raining? David doesn't know it.
Who's raining?
Adi.
Adoni Yov. Now watch. No. I'll tell you why. Let's read the pasuk. Vayomer Natan al Batsheva in Shlomo, Natan said to Batsheva, so I'm saying, everything, the whole story is already being told to us by virtue of the fact that the name Hanavi does not appear in the pasuk. He's acting as an individual. So Natan said to Batsheva, the mother of Shlomo, Halo Shamat. But you heard Ki Molach Adoniyahu ben Chagid. Adoniyahu ben Chagid has ruled, has assumed the throne. What Natan wants to do now is he wants to create the atmosphere as though everything has already happened. He wants to create the sense of the real crisis. Therefore he says, but you've heard that Adoniyahu ben Chagid has ruled by Adoneinu David, Lo Yoda, and our master David doesn't know. V'yatonal l'chi yatzeich na'itzai, will give you advice, u'malki et nafshech, and save yourself, your life, et nefesh b'neich Shlomo, and the life of your son Shlomo. Because if Adoniyahu ben Chagid is going to assume the throne, so even Natan, who knows what the end is going to be, is assuming what would happen in the normal course of events. The one who has assumed the throne is going to make sure that he's going to remove anybody who may be a threat to the throne. So now I advise you, save yourself. Lechi, go, Poi, come. Lechi, Poi. He could have said Lechi, and he could have said Poi. Could have said go, he could have said come. He says Lechi, Poi. You know, you have to read these psukim. You can't interrupt the middle of these psukim. You have to feel the growing intensity. The crisis is building up. We have to move swiftly, quickly. There is absolutely no time to lose. Lechi, Poi, El Amelech David, Va'amartel, go to the king and say to him. And he tells her what to say. Now, another one of the things that I'm going to prepare you for now this week, and of course you have homework. Your homework is you have to read through this entire chapter. I see a number of you are frightened that I'll hand out pieces of paper at the beginning of class next week. You got to read the psukim, because I'll tell you in advance what's going to happen. The story of all things, the story of Adoniyahu ben Chagid is going to be repeated here four times. The same story four times. The pasuk has told us the story. Natan now tells the story to Batsheva. Batsheva is going to come to the king and she's going to tell him the story. And then in the middle of it all, in comes Natan to the king, and he's going to tell the story to Vegmal. Highly unusual. So there are two things that you're going to have to keep in mind, and we will not be able to do all of the work. You're going to have to do some of the work yourself. Each one of the four times is in so many very special ways different than the other. It's not the same. It's the same story being repeated four times, but there's a knetch, a kvetch, a nuance, different each time. And it all depends on who's telling the story. When the Navi, and we're going to point this out, that's going to be one of the important things that we have to see over here. How the Pasuk describes the story. What Natan now is certainly building up the tension and the pressure. Bathsheba is going to have to talk to the king and tell the story in her own way, because she has a relationship with the king and she feels that her relationship with the king is here at stake. When Natan comes in, he's going to speak as one of the people who's been so loyal and so close to the king. He's going to assume, obviously, all of this has happened only with the king's approval. Why didn't you tell me? Everybody, they're going to put David on such a guilt trip. Each one in their own way. So you have to understand, there is never such a thing as a repetition in Tanakh. If there is something that seems to be a repetition, there's meaning and there's substance and there's a method to it all. Which, by the way, or maybe not by the way, this is one of the things I said some years ago, I believe that's another reason why this perek is the Haftorah for Parashat Chayei Sarah. In Parashat Chayei Sarah, there's one big, long story that is repeated twice at great length. And to the extent that the Gemara says, Yofo sichoson shel avdei avot yoser mitoraton shel banim. The talk of the servants of our patriarchs is even greater than the Torah that was given to the children. There are many halachot that we learn out of an extra vav or a little nuance in a pasuk, and hear the whole story of Eliezer coming to the well and how he says, God, make it that the girl whom I will ask to give me water, and she's going to say, not only to you will I give water, but I will give water also to your camels. She is, I mean, which is a pretty silly thing to expect of a 3-year-old girl. 10 Oiz Gevekt, Oiz Gedat, the camels. I don't know. I wonder. It was a long journey, but there was Kvitzas HaDerech. The fact is, Eliezer comes into the house, and he says that he's not going to sit down to eat anything until he tells the story, and he repeats the whole story at great length. I believe that this is the Haftorah, because you know what the Haftorah is telling us? The Haftorah is telling us, if there's a repetition twice in the Sedra, a whole story is repeated twice, in the Haftorah it's repeated four times. And in this repetition of the story four times, which obviously makes you sit up and think, the beauty of the repetitions, they're not simple, each one is very special. This is, the Haftorah is telling us how you're supposed to learn the Sedra. Take a look at the two stories side by side. The way the Torah tells us the story, and the way Eliezer tells it over to Lavan and Betuel, what he leaves out, what he puts in, what he stresses, what he doesn't stress. There's a tremendous, tremendous amount to be learned. So it is the Sedra and the Haftorah that are telling us how to look at one another. You have to look at each one of them and see the differences. I'm not going to give you all of the differences, but we will certainly see some of them. So that's it. But go over the first chapter. You have to learn a chapter a week.